Jeff here from BestTechie.com, and this is Techie Bites episode 28. Today I'm speaking with Craig Vodnik, co-founder and CEO at Cleverbridge. We discuss how he and his co-founders bootstrapped their company to profitability in 2 years, selling in the early days, and angel investing. Enjoy. This podcast is supported by Wix.com. With Wix, you can create your own professional website. Choose a template you love or start from scratch, drag and drop to customize anything, and use advanced design features like video backgrounds and image galleries. You can even add professional business solutions like an online store, booking system, or blog. I've personally tested and reviewed Wix on Best Techie and can say without a doubt that Wix is extremely easy to use and a great choice for both novice and advanced users. So go ahead, try it yourself. Go to Wix.com and create your own website today. That's Wix, W-I-X.com. I'm here with Craig Vodnik, co-founder and CEO of a company called Cleverbridge. He has been at this almost as long as I've been doing Best Techie, I feel like, which is quite close. A while. I've been doing Best Techie for 15 years. Craig, I think you've been doing it for a little over 13 years, right?
Yeah, I think we're over 14 now, right around 15, but I think you've got us by a little bit of time.
Well, that's okay. You guys have grown a lot faster than we have here at Best Techie, but that's good. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. I think this is really exciting. Craig and I have known each other for quite some time, so it's really great to have you on. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And at least this time it's not over a blackjack table in Las Vegas.
Yes, there have been that has been quite the situation that has occurred quite a few times, but that's okay. I mean, that's fun too, right?
So yes, absolutely.
And one of those times, I think you guys got tickets to go see what's that guy's name? The red hair. I always forget his name.
Oh, Carrot Top.
Carrot Top. How could I forget that?
I did not go. I just have to be honest. I have no way. No interest.
Well, awesome. I'm glad we're here today. So before we get into this conversation, which I have a feeling is going to be a really good one, tell everyone a little bit about who you are in more detail and, you know, what you're doing at Cleverbridge and fill them in.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. I'm an engineer by trade, so I actually studied nuclear engineering, which I don't use anymore,
Let me just interrupt you real quick, because I was doing a little bit of research.
Yeah.
When we decided to do this, and I wanted to look into more of your background and stuff, and I had no idea that you were that's what you studied in school. That was news to me. So I was like,
I don't have a tattoo, that's for sure, and no one would know from the outside. I studied nuclear engineering kind of by chance. I mean, it's a long story. I won't go into that. But I really like challenges, and I like kind of math and science and hard problems. It's really fun for me to actually, try to solve problems. I'm actually working on a puzzle at home right now, just like a jigsaw puzzle. And it's just, I hadn't done one in a while, and it's really fun. But anyway, so who am I? I study nuclear engineering. Had always been in computers or into computers growing up, even back in the 80s when there were very early computers. And I just kind of picked up programming on the side when I was in grad school. And the internet, really the web, had just started at that point. So I basically taught myself programming, went from through a couple jobs of learning how to program or programming professionally, being the webmaster of the Chicago Tribune, putting the website up the first time in 1996.
That was also another fact I had learned about you in my research. I had no idea that you were on the team that was responsible for that.
Yeah, it was really, really fun time. I can tell you that. Just, you know, everything was so new. Nobody really knew what was going on. So if you anything was possible. It was really a Wild West at that time. But one thing I realized very quickly was I was not a good programmer. I could hack things together, but I didn't really know anything about the fundamentals of programming. So I very quickly shifted into, I think, what is one of my skills, which is being able to understand the technology, but explain it clearly to people. And so that kind of played itself into moving into more of a business role. And fast forward a few years, I was working for a company that was, I was in Chicago, but this company was in Cologne, Germany. And I got along really well with my colleagues in Germany. That company was acquired. That was Element 5. And so when that happened, myself and a few friends decided to go off and start a business, which is Cleverbridge. And so what we do as a company is we're a global subscription billing platform for digital product companies. When somebody wants to sell a digital product, it can cross borders very easily, which can be complex. We make that really simple for people. And the typical company that works with us is somebody that has that sells into more than three countries, because that's when the complexity starts blowing up. And so we really focus on that digital product space, software, online services, those kinds of things. And you know, we've grown to 300 people, all bootstrapped, and I suspect we'll talk a little bit about that later. But in a nutshell, that's who I am and what I do.
Nice. So, okay, so let's back up a little bit. 2005, you and your two other co-founders decided to start this company, Cleverbridge. Now, the internet in 2005 and just the world in technology was a very different place. I mean,
yeah,
there weren't all these SaaS startups that you think about today that were selling things, you know, digital products online or services online, you know.
Right.
It wasn't nearly as widespread. Why did you guys think that this was a market opportunity to take advantage of?
Well, the company we were working for had done something very similar, so we knew the industry. But what we also knew, and I remember putting this in our business plan back in 2005, was that broadband penetration in the U.S. was about, I think, 50-ish% at that point, was mm-hmm. growing, you know, 4 or 5% a year. And so people were shifting their behavior from going to a store to buy software and doing it online. And so we could see that the trend was going that way, where more and more people were going to buy online. And so we just said, you know, we know this business, we've got some money, we've got ideas on how to you know, how to do things differently and better using the latest technology from 2005. And we knew people in the industry, we knew potential clients. So all of those factors together, you know, we just kind of got together and we said, we love this industry and we think that there's a long way to go on this. Honestly, we probably didn't really think at that point about, you know, people having always on connections on their phones and being able to consume services, you know, without downloading any software. We didn't really think about it at that time in that way. So it was more opportunistic based on what we knew and what we could see, let's say, for the next 5 to 7, 8 years.
Mm-hmm. So when you started, I guess, well, while you had this idea, right? I guess even before you maybe started, or you had started to decide, you teamed up and you were going to launch this company. Did you speak? You said you knew potential customers. Did you speak yep. with them before kind of incorporating or really working on this? Or,
you know, I would say we didn't. I guess I would say it this way: we were, you could call it industry friends, right? It's not like the people you hang out with on the weekend. Mm-hmm. It's more of those people that you see at trade shows or people that are your clients, and you see them, you know them pretty well, and you've got a good relationship with them. You understand what's inside their head about what they think of the industry, you know, your product at that time when we were working for somebody else. So you have a good feeling for, do they align from a values and sort of a vision perspective? And therefore, if you can build a better mousetrap, we speculated, would they be interested to work with us or to bring mm-hmm. their business to us? And until we had our product in a beta version and we're able to show it, I don't really remember us talking to them too much about you know, what we were working on and would they be a client. It was more of, we already know the kinds of things that we wanted to do and do better. And so we just went off in our own sort of vacuum and did that for 6 months before ever showing them what we were working on or talking about it.
Gotcha. So it took you guys from day zero to 6 months in to have a beta product that you could show off?
Yep.
Okay.
I'd probably even call it an alpha, because at that point, at 6 months in, we were not ready for anybody to, I'd say, go live with our product. Mm-hmm. It took another 5 months before our first client went live with a very small sliver of their business, testing us out, seeing how we were compared to the competition. And then once that happened, that started the flywheel going, where it was really just a momentum game, and everything was good, and people started coming over to us.
So that's actually interesting. So that's some new intel that I just got. And considering that I know that you guys bootstrapped CleverBridge to profitability in 2 years, it's more like 1 year, really.
Well, I mean, from the time we were alive, yeah, it's 1 year.
Right.
You know, you gotta eat and drink beer that second year.
Absolutely. But that's still, I mean, to me, that's even more impressive. Like, you spent a year building the product, let's say, right? You know,
yep.
And then a year later, you were already profitable with it. What was that? You know, how did you do that? What did you focus on to make that happen?
Great question. There's two things that I would say on this, and I do talk about this quite a bit, and had not realized it at the time when we were doing it, because, I mean, I'm not a professional entrepreneur per se, but there's two key factors. One is cost side. So we, as the founders, and there were actually four of us, founder executives, and then three other co-founders that were developers that started with us. None of us were taking a salary at that time. Right. So you can't be, I mean, you have to have a financial source to be able to do that. We were all in our 30s when we started the business. So we had some cushion to work off of in order to support ourselves. So cost side, right, profitable, but that was without us paying ourselves any salary at all. Second, and probably more important factor in this is the business model itself. A lot of these freemium business models are such that you're giving away the product, trying to get people to use it in order to much later make money. Think about Amazon as one example of a very public example doing this. But for us, the nature of our business is such that we were essentially signing enterprise contracts with companies where in, you know, the second and third year, a company would sign a contract with us. They would move their existing business from someone else to us. That would be like the equivalent of us getting a $200,000 a year contract with each account that we signed. Right. And so that supports a lot of that supports quite a bit on the salary side of things, which is what helped us get, you know, basically break even and then profitable very quickly after that first year.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about this enterprise sales. The enterprise sales cycle, but also B, how you came up with pricing. Because I've talked to other founders for B2B products, and pricing always is a very difficult thing to kind of nail down, right? How did you guys approach it?
So great question. Again, I think we were very fortunate, and I've said this before, and I'll say it here for you, is I feel like we were blissfully ignorant during the early years of CleverBridge. We really didn't know what we were doing. We were just sort of following along what we knew from the industry. And the reason I say that is because in this specific case, when you talk about pricing, we basically went with what the industry sort of pricing had been in a general sense, which is a percentage of revenue. So for every dollar, you know, our job, we're effectively like a cash register, right? So we're collecting the money on behalf of our client. We keep our percentage and then we hand the rest over. Think like Stripe and Braintree and those kinds of things. It's somewhat similar. Mm-hmm. The really important part here, though, is that when you talk about pricing, we were able to attach our price to something that's very valuable to our clients, which was, you know, payment collection. And so when we look at our pricing, like we could have said something to the effect of, hey, let's charge for the platform to use it on an annual basis. We'll charge a maintenance fee, and then we'll just do straight pass-through on all of the revenue that we collect. That's one way we could have done it, and that's actually the way that a lot of traditional, let's say, retail-focused e-commerce companies do it. But that's because they don't actually take on the role of merchant of record like we do. And what that means is we are responsible for collecting the revenue, collecting the payment, charging the appropriate tax, dealing with compliance and legal rules around the world. So we basically tied our pricing to the value that we were offering, and it just so happened that it was easy to say, well, our value is just a higher percentage of the money that we collect. So it's it's changed over the years. Pricing has definitely changed, and you get into things like mixed pricing where it's a percentage plus a fixed amount. You know, those prices drop on, let's say, maybe domestic U.S. transactions, but we charge a higher percentage on non-U.S. transactions because those are more expensive. So it's pricing is a really complex topic, and we're in, I think, a market that it was relatively easy to set pricing. But I know, having talked to a lot of people, how challenging pricing is as a general topic.
Right, and also, I don't know if you guys still offer, like I remember you guys when I would check out and I would notice it was a Clever Rich page. You guys would also offer, and this is like going back, a CD like version of the software if you wanted it as an additional cost to the person buying it. I don't know if you guys still offer those CDs. Do you?
There are what? How many millions of AOL dial-up subscribers are still out there? I mean,
that's true. There are quite a few million. Yeah.
So yeah, short answer. Yeah, we still offer it. It's not as big, I'd say, as it used to be, but I'm kind of surprised as well that some people just feel really only feel comfortable if they have that tangible thing that they can put on a shelf and say, I paid money for this and here it is. Nobody can take it away from me. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a mentality that will change over time because so many products going forward, new things that are created are not delivered in that physical fashion or won't be. It's only consumed through the internet. And right. That's going to require people to change their mentality about it.
No, absolutely. So you mentioned Stripe just before. Now, yep. Stripe was a company that wasn't around in 2005, or even 2006, 2007. I forgot exactly when they were founded, but it wasn't that long ago. Yep. How do you guys view, how do you at Cleverbridge and you as the CEO of Cleverbridge view Stripe? Are they a competitor of yours now, or what is that relationship like?
Yeah, I think you could view them as a competitor. I would put PayPal out there as a better example of, if you will, a frenemy, right? Because Stripe is a great tool for entry-level companies, right? When you're just trying to get started and you just want to plug something in, or you want to kind of own the whole thing, Stripe is a great way to get started. But the problem comes in when the complexity, or when your business grows and it becomes more complex. You're selling into more countries. You're dealing with taxation. You know, the many rules that are changing around not only the U.S. but the world in terms of how you have to handle customer data, privacy,
and now with GDPR, you guys, I'm sure, take all that into account when taking people's information. Yeah,
exactly. So Stripe is like this great like baseline piece. And it's great to start with, but there's so much that you have to add on top of it, which is where we come in. We add all that stuff on top. Are they a competitor? Not really. People don't choose between Cleverbridge and Stripe.
Right.
They generally look at the problem that they're trying to solve, and then they look for the right solution. People who start with Stripe and continue with Stripe over the cliff, because they just say that this is such a great technology, I have to keep using it, they end up going over the cliff because they run into all kinds of problems that they essentially have to reinvent the wheel in developing with their internal systems and people. PayPal's a really good example, though, of somebody who I think has done it right, where they, you know, that you can people surprised. I think before Stripe came along, PayPal was much more of that entry-level solution that people would use in order to just accept credit cards. But PayPal's really got a nice ecosystem going whereby companies can use PayPal to do what I said, just collect credit cards or accept payment. You can also obviously accept payment from then people who have a PayPal account. But we actually plug PayPal in as just a payment method in the shopping experience and the subscribe experience, because it's considered a pretty healthy and used or popular payment method around the world. And in Germany, for example, I want to say it's like 30%+ of online transactions through our system are done with PayPal. Mm-hmm. By far the most of any country. And it's because of the culture in Germany where they're privacy is so important to them. They don't want to give the credit card out. They'd rather just send the money via PayPal. And it's a very popular payment method there. But again, they've opened their system up to play nice with other people. And so they don't really care if they're just a payment method or if they're handling all of the customer buying experience.
Right. It's actually interesting that you bring up the whole PayPal thing up, because two things. One, there was recently an article on The Atlantic by Taylor Lorenz, and she wrote how kids love PayPal because they're not old enough to have a credit card, but they can have a PayPal account. And they're paying for things with their PayPal account. And the second little tidbit that I found interesting was when my wife Mandy was running her online boutique, she didn't accept PayPal payments right away. And then she decided one day, all right, I'm going to start accepting payments over PayPal as well as credit cards. And her sales increased a lot. People just prefer to pay with PayPal sometimes. There's a huge percentage of the population out there that definitely likes to use it.
Jeff, I think it's actually different than what you just said. And I'll tell you why, because it's the way I think. It's a slush fund. the money you have in your PayPal account, when I go to something, I'm like, do I really want this? You know, should I buy it? I mean, it's $40, for example. You know, you just go, okay, well, I have that money in PayPal. So you don't feel like it's really coming out of your monthly budget or it's coming out. It's not coming directly out of your bank account. It's in your PayPal account. And people think about it as a slush fund.
That could certainly be true. I mean, I could totally see that. I mean, that does make some sense to me.
I like my PayPal account. I can tell you that.
Awesome. Well, that's good. It's good to hear that you like PayPal. I actually like PayPal too. I get a lot of PayPal payments for Best Techie stuff that we do. A lot of people prefer to pay with PayPal. But I'm curious to know, you know, and I've heard through the grapevine that Cleverbridge is planning to kind of expand their offerings a bit. What can you tell me or tell us about that, if anything?
Sure. Yeah. You know, in a way, it's sort of the story. It's the evolution of software, right? The evolution of consuming, let's say, services, where you know software was essentially you're wanting to do something. And you know, you're buying a desktop productivity tool, or you're buying a CD, you know, making software, whatever it was, you know, 10 years ago. Antivirus is another one. And so the evolution of software is such that people are delivering software experiences or services through the web. They're no longer providing that as a service. As a download product. And so it's very analogous to what we've been doing over the years of providing an e-commerce platform for billing for these software companies on a global basis. But the way that services are sold and consumed requires a slightly different style and focus of a company's business it requires a different infrastructure, so to say. It's more API driven. It's more about revenue retention. It's more about customer accounts, something that is more customer centric than transaction centric. And so we are working on and are very soon releasing a new way of interacting with our platform that is more API driven than call it like full stack, a black box version.
Gotcha. That's super interesting to me, because I, you know, there's clearly a huge market, you know, that of businesses that would love to, I guess, utilize your product and your service in a different way. You know, they may not need the kind of way it's set up now. If that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's just different. You know, people are, yeah. There's a real shift going on in the market of how consumer, I mean, how many times, Jeff, do you have right now a subscription to some online service, right? Spotify, yeah. Something like that. A lot more than you did 5 years ago.
Yeah. And now even apps are moving towards subscription based models as well. I mean, typically you guys know, but like there was, every year you had your antivirus renewal, right? Or something like that. But now, like, even small apps, you know, they have, you know, like $3.99 a month or, you know, something like that.
Well, so. And when you think about like Salesforce, I think they really sort of set the stage for a lot of this, where the value you're getting, Dropbox being another one, the value you're getting is the data being stored in somebody else's cloud or somebody else's servers, and therefore the value to you or the justification given by the business is, hey, we're doing something for you every day. We're the backup provider, right? You used to have the backup drive that you'd plug into your home computer in order to prevent yourself from losing your data on your hard drive. Well, that's all been moved to the cloud, right? It's AWS, it's Dropbox, it's Box.net, it's all these guys. And you're paying for that on a monthly basis because they're doing a service for you, which is making sure you don't lose your data. And so businesses are really finding new ways, they're finding new value that they can offer consumers and businesses that actually aligns well with a subscription business model. And companies that think about their businesses in that way, not in saying, I want to pick my customers' pockets every month for money, but instead saying, I want to offer value to my my customers, and I want to use the technology as it exists today in order to do that. A lot of times that results in a really very reasonable monthly subscription bill for the customer.
Do you feel that we're on track to be, let's say, oversubscribed? Go with me on that. Like, are we on track for too many of these subscription based models?
I think like Gartner has in their they have a wave, kind of, it's not called the wave, but it's a hype cycle, and we're certainly going to see pushback from consumers on subscription products. I know that, you know, there's like cars is a good example. Look at Tesla. I don't own a Tesla. I've never owned a car. Don't want a car. But on Tesla, they have control over you from remote if they wanted to. I don't know if they do this, but they could charge you a monthly fee to access those updates that allow the car to run faster, to, you know, turn better, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you have a car that was not internet connected, you basically own that car. And so people... This is probably a 30-year societal shift, right? People are used to owning, and we're moving towards this rental society. There's going to be a pushback at some point where people say, hey, I don't want any more subscriptions. But the next generation that comes along, it will just be second nature to them, and they'll wonder, why did anybody own anything before?
Right. No, interesting point. I personally am not 100% sure how I feel about it all the way. I think... You know, there are certain things that I like to say I own, but that's maybe just because I'm stuck in my way, in particular ways specific things.
Think about music. Music is the perfect example that it went from ownership society to rental, and it actually made a pretty seamless transition, I think, over the last 3 years, right? Everybody had tapes, then CDs. And, you know, you used to burn stuff on CDs, and then you had your digital music library in iTunes or wherever. You had it on your computer. You had to put that on a backup drive because you didn't want to lose it. It took so much time, right, to create it. And then Spotify comes along and just knocks it out of the park, makes it really easy for people to stream the music. And that's only possible because of all of the always-on devices that are now out there, right?
Right, right.
Reliable internet access and those types of devices. Without that, it's not possible to offer that type of solution. But music has really made that transition right in front of us all the last 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I was one of those holdouts for the longest time up until Apple released Apple Music. I was not subscribed to a music subscription service. I just don't like Spotify that much. Mm-hmm. I don't like the player. I just didn't really like it. I felt like a lot of the times I felt like the catalog was lacking in certain areas. I'm sure it's better now, but yeah, I mean, I just got a bad feel for it, and I just never really used it.
Jeff, let's be honest. It's because it didn't have an Apple logo next to it. Am I right or am I right?
You're right. That was certainly a very large part of it. I just was convinced that they were going to come out with a music subscription model at some point. It just made sense. So I want to go back to bootstrapping a little and talking about that a little bit more in terms of, like, what is bootstrapping? Like, for you guys at Cleverbridge, that's what you had money that you had saved up. Mm-hmm. You and your co-founders put it into the business, said, all right, we're gonna commit this amount of money to get started. And yep. And that's what you did. And I guess, you know, when it's interesting because I'm sure you have much more control over the business now than if you had taken outside capital. Obviously. Yep. So you have much more control and say in terms of, you know, I guess alongside your founder or your co-founders, or this is what we're going to do, you know, and you don't have some outside investor kind of breathing down your neck saying, no, you know, have you seen what so-and-so's doing? We need to, you know, they want to see their returns on their investment. Yep. And things like that. But I guess my question is, when is it the right time to bootstrap, and when is it the right time to take outside money, if there is such a delineation, you know, fine line between choosing one or the other?
Yeah, it's a very complex question, actually.
Yeah.
Not because of the way you asked it, but just the question itself is quite complex. You know, so when's the right time to bootstrap? I think areas I would consider. It's not, there's a couple areas to consider. So first of all, can you afford to bootstrap, right? Not a lot of people can. You know, you're generally, it would be an entrepreneur that's a little later, you know, has some experience, has some money put away, maybe has a team of founders, maybe has some family money that they can put to work. That's one way that it could be a good idea to bootstrap. The second point I would make is, if the business is one, like in our business, I think enterprise sales, where we were collecting money, we didn't have a collections issue. You know, we could take big steps forward with each contract, which we could get relatively easily. That was the business model really made a lot of sense for us to bootstrap. But conversely, I think that if there's an opportunity to grow really fast and own a market, I'd say that's even if it's an enterprise product, I'm not sure that that's a good time to bootstrap, because when there's a greenfield out there, someone else will likely come along once they see your idea and if it starts working, and they will then find a way to invest in it or put, you know, 5, 10, 15 million to work with a small team, and they could actually overpass you. So, you know, when there's that big green field in front of you, I think that that's a good time to consider taking investment. Obviously, it comes with some risk and a lot of gray hair, I would argue. But and I have gray hair too, but it's not because of taking money, just age. So you know, it's if you're a single a founder, it's also sometimes hard to get investment because investors typically look for teams. Mm-hmm. They want to know that it's not all riding on just one person and their individual skill set or their mental sanity. you know, if it's a freemium model, it's probably hard to bootstrap. So again, going back to business model, I think that that also gives an indication of which way you want to go. You know, if you, there's a great quote or a great question I ask people when they ask for money. I say, do you want to be king or do you want to be rich? It does, it, they're not mutually exclusive, but it's hard to be both. And you can be king if you are bootstrapping because you don't have to answer to somebody else. But you can get rich a lot faster, let's say, or maybe even a bigger bank account perhaps, if you take money, because you're theoretically accelerating the end date of that company, hopefully at a much higher valuation than you would if you were bootstrapping. Right. So there's a lot of different things to consider there. And, you know, what do you personally want, I think, is usually the place that I start. What do people, what's really driving the person to do what they want to do? And then also looking at that business model might require you to go one way or another.
Mm-hmm. That's some good advice. I have to agree with it as well. I think, you know, because you could be cash poor and equity rich and be the king. But you know, if you can't grow the business in a way that that it needs to be grown, then you're not going to make any progress, really.
Yeah, I mean, I look at a lot of companies, especially ones that once they've sold, and you know, I'm very surprised in a lot of cases how well, you know, certain businesses did that I would have thought never in a million years would I ever invest in that or think that it could be as big as it turned out to be. But at the same time, you also hear a lot of these stories about companies that have investment and maybe they've raised 60, 70, 80 million and they get sold for pennies on the dollar because something went wrong in that process, or maybe the business shouldn't, you know, there's lots of different things that happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, it's a very, you know, Snap is a good example. Snap wouldn't exist if they, or Twitter for that matter, those businesses wouldn't exist today if they didn't have venture money,
right?
Because they couldn't afford, they couldn't afford to pay for all those people to help build it, to do the land grab at that time. So,
no, that's a good point. We're going to talk about investing in just a second, but before we do, let's go back to your early days at Cleverbridge, okay? Mm-hmm. And where you were bringing on some of, let's say, the first customers, potential customers that you were talking to, was it tough? You know, what did you learn after the first couple pitches?
Yeah. Well, I'm laughing because the first client that we won in the U.S., which I pitched and convinced him and all that, within, I think, about 3 months, we lost the first one. He went online, and then it's a long story. It goes back to a bandwidth question or bandwidth comment I made earlier about internet access at that time, but basically, you know, we lost that first one after he already signed and then, you know, was A/B testing us. So it's a little bit of a painful memory, but, you know, the thing is I really enjoyed it. Once I learned what I was doing from a sales perspective, I really enjoyed those pitches and especially the early days, because that's when you as the founder or a very early employee have so much control over the ultimate success of the business, because there's not many people in the company, and what you do and how you act and how much effort you put into it goes a long way towards setting the curve at which you're going to be growing over the, you know, in the future.
Right.
So things I learned, I mean, I learned so much in those early years. I think in the early days, I just used to sell, hey, we have a really cool product, let me show you. The product often sold itself. And over the years, I would start getting questions from people. And I know there was a transition maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago where I realized that, especially as we started talking to larger companies, the people we were talking to, they didn't care about our product, honestly, one bit. Let's say they didn't want to see it. They couldn't care less what it looked like. It could not sell itself. Those people were looking at me as a founder and as an executive of Cleverbridge and wanting to know, is this somebody I can do business with? What about all of the things outside of the the product itself. What's your continuity plan, you know, business continuity? Mm-hmm. How many data centers do you have? What happens if you can't meet payroll? Like, there's all this other stuff that comes into the discussion that could easily derail
especially for a company like Cleverbridge, which is literally handling their money. if you guys
just
shut down, exactly. If people couldn't buy something simply, it didn't, or there was constant issues, or it was always down, or you guys just packed it up and went home.
Yeah,
you know, they'd be left in the lurch and in very bad situation.
reputation takes a minute to destroy and a lifetime to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you're sitting across from those people, and so I mean, it was really interesting, especially reflecting on a lot of those conversations, a lot of those meetings, those presentations, you know, looking at the questions, and then also having somebody or other people with you that you could then later discuss, hey, when I said this, you know, I could tell that that wasn't the right answer, or that was not what they expected.
Right. What was the reaction in the room like? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was for me.
It's like reading a jury.
Yeah.
It's like exactly. Yeah.
In a way, yeah. It wasn't Perry Mason. It was something better, hopefully. But it was really, really, really fun. I mean, I love that part of it. I love getting out and talking to people, and especially the competitive aspect of it was really, really fun. But, I mean, it's just sales is hard. I think that what we've learned is the best salespeople are, especially in what we do, so this wouldn't apply for everybody, but I think it's going that direction in general in society is – it's all about it's about trust, being a thought leader, being a resource to the person or the business that you're trying to sell, and not really selling directly, right? You're helping to educate them and trying to show why you as a person representing a business is somebody that they should consider and hopefully trust giving their business to. No matter what kind of product it is, at least from an enterprise, a B2B perspective. And, you know, so that's why I personally do a fair amount of blogging and, you know, I'm on Instagram and all this kind of stuff, showing not just the work side of things, but also showing some of the personal side of what I'm interested in so that people know that there's a real person here, not just somebody trying to, you know, sell, so to say.
Right. No, and from what I understand, you're a bit of an audiophile. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're at least into audio gear.
Yeah,
right? I checked out your Instagram, and there's a lot of do you consider them refurbished or refinished or?
Yeah, but mostly.
Really cool,
mostly refurbished. So I just have picked up a hobby of refurbishing 1950s and 60s stereo consoles. Never took any electrical engineering classes, had to learn how to read these electrical diagrams, figure out, you know, watch YouTube videos, read blogs, stay at a Holiday Inn Express to figure out how to do this stuff. And it's been really fun. And it's just like, I mean, I have a beautiful 1965 Grundig stereo in my office where I play records and actually still listen to the radio. But I set up a Bluetooth. I created a Bluetooth connector for it so I can stream music through it. And it's a great talking point. You know, people love seeing it and just sort of discussing it. And it's really, I think, making a comeback in the market, because I know a lot of people now that are really interested in this, even if they haven't actually invested in one yet. But right. I refurbish them in my basement for fun.
How did you get into that? Was it just like you saw one walking down the street one day, you're like, I'm going to bring this home? Or how did that happen?
I probably saw a few on the streets over the years and always thought, well, what the hell? I don't want to touch that. But what really happened was I was probably 20 years ago was clearing out my grandmother's house and with my uncle. And he said to me, we were down to the last couple pieces in the house. And he said, oh, here's this stereo from, you know, your mom gave it to your grandparents for their 25th wedding anniversary in 1962. I was like, wow, that's really cool. Never knew that. He said, do you want it? I don't want it. I said, yeah, I'd love to have it. I don't know what I'll do with it. And so I basically put it in storage for about 15 years. And then one day, one of my employees here, he was telling me about records. And, you know, he's 24, 25 at the time. And he's talking about records. And I just kind of scoffed at him, but I said, you know, I've got some records in my basement if you want to come by and take a look through them. And that one thing led to another, and then I was there showing him some of the records. It gave him a few. I thought, you know, I have some time now. Maybe I'll try to figure out how to get this stereo working. And that's kind of how it all began. And then when I finished or was working on the first one, I realized that people were still selling and throwing them away on Craigslist. So I went online and I started buying them up and just storing them in my basement. So at one point I probably had 6 or 7 of them in there just waiting to, you know, I didn't even know how to fix them yet, but I just thought they were beautiful and all that. So anyway, that's how I got into it.
Nice. So are you like a big vinyl record guy or do you prefer like the digital audios?
I'm definitely into vinyl now. I mean, I've over the last 3 or 4 years, I've probably bought, I don't know, 200 or 300 records and acquired some other ones from my uncle that he basically got for free from other people. So it's really fun. And interestingly enough, though, Jeff, I am also now into refurbishing CRT TVs. So I got, again, to this whole idea of, you know, wanting to continue to evolve and learn new stuff. I was at one house, I was buying a stereo, and then there was a TV there. It didn't work, and they said it didn't work. They said $50, and I looked at it, and I thought, well, someday I'll have time to work on this. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, a couple years ago, I got inspired, and these are dangerous.
Careful. Be very careful with those cathode ray tubes.
Oh, I've been shocked a few times. Don't worry. That's why I'm crazy.
Awesome. Well, okay. So I have one more question I want to talk about with you about investing before we get to the lightning round. Okay. And that has, so you've been doing some angel investing. From what I understand from your angel.co page, you've actually had 2 exits as well, so congrats on that. What do you look for when you're investing in a company? You know, what kind of companies do you like to invest in?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. When I first started doing it, I had no idea what I was doing. So I thought every company could be successful because as an entrepreneur, I looked at them and said, well, I could see how that can work. Mm-hmm. And then with age or let's say experience and realizing some of them weren't good investments, I started saying, okay, I'm only going to invest in things that I know. So it's e-commerce, it's, you know, software, it's those kinds of things. And now, you know, I see things that I've, again, missed on because it was a CPG product or some software for an industry I had no idea about and I didn't invest in it. So what that has taught me is I don't know what I'm doing. I can't pick winners, but
it's a very tough thing to do. Yeah. Well, you're following Warren Buffett's advice, though, right? Invest in what you know. That's typically what he says, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it hasn't worked out for me yet. Let's put it that way. But what I would say is it's the entrepreneur, right? At the end of the day, I mean, they talk about it being the horse or the jockey, not the horse. And I think there's mm-hmm. a lot of truth to that because the jockey is the one that when you run into that stormy cloud, the jockey is the one that's going to tell the horse to go around the storm or go through it and head this way. So a lot of it is jockey. I think I sort of mentioned this earlier, business model. You know, the business model is so critical to the success of a company. And if an entrepreneur doesn't understand what the business model is, or let's say is looking at selling something for $9.99 a month, you got to sell a lot of those. And mm-hmm. so that, you know, there's actually some kind of good structure around this to say, you know, when the sales price, the average contract value is, let's say, $100,000, well, that's probably a pretty good business depending on how many are out there that you could sell to. If it's $10,000, it gets harder. If it's $10 a month, you got to sell millions of those for it to be a venture investable business. So there's some rules that investors have now, or at least that I've seen them talking about, that help guide that decision-making process around the business model. But certainly it's the people, and you know, I do like to invest in things where I know something about the industry, specifically software and commerce. But I would say I would invest in things outside of that now, only because I've learned you never know. You have to get enough investments out there to play portfolio theory, and that's why actually investors in general don't bet like all of their chips on one or two hands, right? They take and they spread the chips around because they don't know either. And that's the dirty secret. They know that they don't know who's going to win.
Right. No, exactly. And it's actually funny that what you were saying before, quick story, and then we'll get to the lightning round. So I was at this this tech event, like people were, I guess, pitching their companies, and then I was in the audience, and I started asking all these questions, and then the funniest thing happened to me after the event. Some woman comes up to me and she goes, "Are you a venture capitalist?" I said, "No, why?" "No, why?" She goes, "You were asking some really good questions, like just stuff like an investor would ask." I'm like, "Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that." So maybe in another life I can become a venture capitalist.
Everybody's looking for money nowadays, right? And money's pretty easy to get with the economy the way it is and, you know, the stock market and everything. But
dumb money and you got your the money that you actually want, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, Craig, you've made it through to the lightning round, which, of course, is supported by Wix, where you can create a professional website today at wix.com. That's wix.com. So, Craig, whenever you're ready, you let me know, and we'll get started.
Oh, let's wait about 10 minutes, and then I'll be
ready. All right, I'm going to go get a drink, and I'll be back, okay?
All right. Well, I'm ready.
All right. Best kind of pizza?
Ooh. I suspected you were going to ask this. You know, I'm not a deep dish pizza fan that much.
Okay.
But
you have to let everyone know you're actually based in Chicago.
I am based in Chicago. And I do like some deep dish, but I'm definitely not a New York pizza fan. So I would say...
I'm ending this right now.
That's fine. Thin crust pizza is my favorite. So it's not really Chicago-style deep dish. I mean, I'm not trashing it, but I'm not a big fan of it either.
Interesting. So I actually just learned about a new type of pizza called Detroit style, which is actually I think really good too.
What's Detroit style?
It's like it's kind of like deep dish, but it's not as deep and it's more crispy. You might like it if you like thin crust. It's interesting. And like they you can put, like, I had one with like peppers and like I don't know, maybe artichoke or like a bunch of things on it. It was really good.
If there's green stuff on it, I don't want it.
Okay. I don't remember the exact details. The peppers might have been green.
Is that Pizza Rat still running around New York?
He might be. I haven't seen him lately.
That guy's pretty cool.
That rat. Mac or PC?
Oh, another good one. You know, it's probably going to be shocking to your audience, but I'm a Chromebook guy. And that's because I like to think different.
That's a combination of worlds right there.
Yeah.
What's your favorite season?
Oh, good question. I guess I'm a summer guy. I mean, I do like fall and spring, but I'd say summer is definitely preferred for me.
Not a fan of the Chicago winter, though.
No. I mean, it's okay, but it's, yeah. Who would choose to live in, you know, the north if they didn't have to, right? Uh-huh. For those winters. If you could eliminate the winters, I think, you know, living in New York or Chicago and Milwaukee, it can't be beat. But the winters, yeah, that's the big negative.
Uh-huh. Uber or Lyft?
Lyft. Marvel? Gotta have a moral compass.
Exactly. Well, Dara over at Uber now is trying to turn... Have you seen all those TV commercials? He's trying to turn things around. Oh, okay.
Oh, good.
Marvel or DC Comics?
Oh, that's one I honestly can't answer. What's the group that has Batman?
DC.
So I'd probably say DC because Kevin or was it Nolan?
Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan. Those movies were pretty amazing. So I'd have to say them. But I'm not a big comic universe person.
Okay, fair enough. I love the Nolan Batman trilogy as well. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Last one, here we go. Favorite piece of tech that you own?
Oof. So now by tech, could that be 1960s tech?
Sure. Could be anything. Anything tech related.
Yeah, I'd probably say... okay, so I have a 1961 stereo console. So that has a turntable, a radio, and it's all tube-based. And it has a TV built into it that I'm restoring right now. That's my favorite piece.
That sounds pretty awesome. You're gonna have to send me a picture of that. I
Yeah,
want
I
to see
will.
that once it's all set up.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's in immaculate condition for what, 55 years old. And I'm still trying to get it all working, but I got the radio working, the TV. It's going to take a little more work.
Cool. Well, you'll have to keep me posted. Awesome. Well, you made it through the lightning round. I think this went great. I have one last request of you. So if
Sure.
anyone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Best way would be through Twitter or Instagram at Craig Vodnik, CRAIGVODNIK, or my last name at cleverbridge.com. You can send me an email.
Awesome. Well, Craig, really great having you on the podcast. It's been wonderful. I really appreciate you you coming by and talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Really great catching up with you. It was quite funny and fun conversation, and love your podcast.
Thanks for listening to Techie Bites. Stay tuned for more episodes every Tuesday with awesome interviews and conversations about technology and business. If you like what we're doing, please consider supporting the podcast at anchor.fm/besttechie and or by leaving a rating and review on iTunes. Both ways help us greatly and are much appreciated. So thank you. Until next time, we'll see you. And remember, take care of your computers.